Mr. Gattis?
Yes, good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, Justice Jacobs. Jeff Gattis, my role is to introduce John Crossman of the firm of Zuckerman, Gore, Brandeis, and Crossman. His pro hoc admission has been granted by this court, and he'll handle the argument for the appellee.
Thank you. Welcome to the court. Mr. Ross?
May it please the court. In Delaware, and indeed across the country, the standard remedy for breach of contract is expectation damages. When properly applied, expectation damages put the non-breaching party in the position that it would have been in if the breaching party had performed its contractual obligations. In this case, the trial court properly found as a matter of fact that the defendant breached a contract which required it to work in good faith to close a transaction on the settled economic terms reflected in the party's detailed contract. Despite that, the court failed in its award of damages to fully compensate Titan and put it in the position that it would have been in if Freedom had performed its contractual obligations.
And was that a factual finding or a legal error?
We believe, Justice Ridgely, that the court committed legal error in two respects with respect to its damage award. First, the court failed to award Titan its full expectation damages because it concluded that the transaction likely would not have closed. But we believe that that conclusion was legally erroneous. Second, with respect to Titan's entitlement to damages on its contractual right to increase the size of the facility by $75 million, we believe the court applied the wrong standard in determining whether or not Titan was even entitled to damages. For these reasons, we believe that the judgment should be reversed in part, that Titan is entitled to judgment granting it its full expectation damages with respect to the initial $25 million, and that the case should be remanded so that the court can consider under the proper standard whether Titan is entitled to damages with respect to the $75 million and what that damage amount is.
Well, in computing expectation damages, and isn't there some element of whether or not the expectation will be realized? And by analogy, I was thinking about someone brings a medical malpractice case and their lawyer misses the statute of limitations. When you bring your case for legal malpractice, the measure of damages in part will depend on the merit of your medical malpractice case that was missed.
We completely agree, Justice Holland. We believe that the court discussed why it is that it concluded the transaction likely not have closed. And that's one thing that you certainly need to look at. That's the first of two factors that need to be considered: the likelihood that the transaction would have closed, and then the court's ability to value with reasonable certainty the lost expectation. The court explained why it believed the transaction likely would not have closed. The court said, in its opinion, that the transaction had no momentum, and that's why the court believed the transaction likely would not have closed.
Just to narrow the issue, is it fair to say that what this case boils down to is how we measure expectation damages?
Yes, Justice Jacobs. We believe that this case boils down to how you determine in a contract that imposes obligations to negotiate, how you determine the expectation damages. And as I said, we believe there are two components to that. You need to look at the likelihood that the transaction would have closed, and then you need to look at how you value the expectation. And those are independent analyses. So in other words, for example, in this case, on the first point, the likelihood that the transaction would have closed, we had a detailed contract. It was 14 pages, most of it single-spaced. It resulted from 3 months of negotiations between the parties. It contained all of the essential economic terms, and it crafted very narrow conditions to the defendant's obligation to close the facility. There were only two conditions. First, Titan had to provide the contractually required commitments. Second, the transaction had to be reasonably certain to close. You can contrast that with lots of other cases and some of the cases we discussed.
Well, let's stop there for a minute. Putting aside the economic terms, one of the issues is whether there had been a fulfillment of the obligation to provide satisfactory investment letters or what, you know, subscription agreements. Can't remember what the term is. You know, the court indicated that that had not happened, and that that had to be taken into account in determining the likelihood that the transaction would close.
We read the court's opinion slightly differently in terms of what it said about the LBC commitment letter, and that was the only commitment letter with respect to which Freedom had any issues. The court said several things about the Freedom about the LBC commitment letter. It said at page 14 of its opinion that LBC committed to participate as a co-buyer. It also said on page 14 that Titan had its commitments in place by July, and it said on page 4 of its opinion that LBC agreed to commit $20 million to the Freedom investment. In finding that the transaction likely would not have closed, what the court said was that Freedom had concerns about the LBC commitment letter. Not that it hadn't provided an appropriate commitment, but that Freedom had concerns. Freedom's concerns...
So you're saying that the court didn't connect all the dots.
We're saying, Your Honor,
because the court, the result that the court reached could be read as implicitly finding that the transaction would not have closed because of those concerns, because of the nonconformity of the LBC commitment letter.
It could be read that way, Your Honor, and this is actually one of the legal errors that we believe the court made. In contract law, where a party performs, even a good faith belief by the breaching party that the other party has not performed does not excuse performance. This was a binary question, not whether or not Freedom was concerned about the commitments.
Wait. Let me just make sure I have that right. Let's move down from the jargon level to the real earth. Are you saying that because of the timing of the contract breach, that would have eliminated whatever choice or discretion Titan had, not Titan, but the Freedom, had to reject the LBC commitment letter for nonconformity?
I'm sorry, Justice Chief, but that's not what I was saying.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that where Titan performs, even if there was a letter in the file where Freedom had written and said, you know, we don't think this is an appropriate commitment. If the court looks and concludes that Titan could have provided the required commitments, and indeed the court found on pages 4 and 14, as I discussed earlier, made several factual findings with respect to the LBC commitment letter, then the fact that Freedom may have had a belief that Titan had not performed is not an excuse where Titan has in fact, for example, as the court found, satisfied the contract. And if we look at Freedom's own authority, it says this very clearly. In the Hiffen versus Intel opinion, on page 14, the Court of Chancery said that even a good faith belief that the other party is already in breach does not privilege a party to repudiate its contract. If I, as a contracting party, have performed, the fact that my...
Excuse me. I need to call your attention to one sentence on page 27 of the slip opinion, which is Exhibit A to your brief, where it does appear that the court made the finding that you suggested had not in fact been made. And I'm quoting here, where the court says, indeed, 4 months after the initial agreement and days before the commitment letters were due, Titan forwarded a 134-page repurchase agreement modeled after Freedom's present banking arrangement with J.P. Morgan. When this is considered together with concerns about the commitments from LBC, commitments even Titan initially had concerns with, it is obvious that there was that this was a deal with no momentum, which probably would not have come to a final conclusion.
We completely agree, Your Honor, that is the portion of the opinion that's relevant. If I take the sense that concerns the LBC commitment, what the court does not say is that combined with the fact that Titan failed to provide the appropriate commitments. This is focused only on what Freedom thought about the commitments. And our point is that even if Freedom had a good faith belief that Titan had not performed, if we go back to pages 4 and 14, where the court found that Titan had its commitments in place, that LBC had, in fact, committed to participate, that it would be a breach of contract for Freedom to say, we don't think they're appropriate commitments. If we came into court and litigated that, and the court finds that we have provided the appropriate commitments, as we believe the court found on pages 4 and 14, then it's not a defense not to go forward with the transaction simply because Freedom views the issue differently and doesn't think we've provided the required commitments. And that is where we think the court erred, because the court said that LBC could walk away because it was concerned about the commitments. But if we have performed, and as I said, we believe the court found that we did, then the fact that Freedom may have been uncertain or formed a contrary belief as to whether or not we had performed does not excuse it. We provided the required commitments letter. That is what the contract required.
So if I understand your side correctly, it's that the court, by failing to connect a very critical dot, namely to make a formal finding that the LBC commitment letter was nonconforming, the court erred.
With a slight variation on that, Justice Jacobs, we think that by looking at Freedom's concern and not returning to the portion of its opinion where it found that we had performed, having found that we had performed, the fact that Freedom was concerned at the time about whether or not we had performed is not an excuse, and it's not a basis to find no momentum, because had Freedom refused to proceed on the grounds that it was concerned about the commitment, that would be a breach in the face of a conforming commitment.
Okay, so you're saying not only it's not so much that the court failed to connect the dot by not making a finding, but to the contrary, the court did make a finding and it was adverse to Freedom.
Exactly, Your Honor. We think that in light of that finding, it's not privileged to walk away because of its concerns. And I'd like then to turn to the prior sentence that Your Honor read, talking about the fact, the other no momentum point. This was the other point that the court identified in terms of why it thought the transaction had no momentum, namely that Freedom expected a simpler document than the initial draft provided by Titan at the outset of a 90-day negotiation period as provided for in this contract. This contract imposed upon both parties a duty to work in good faith for up to 90 days, 45 days, and then if additional time was needed, another 45 days to get to the final documentation. The contract does not impose upon either party the burden of producing the first draft. This was a shared obligation. The court said on page 25 of its opinion, it explains the no momentum point here.
But before you get there, I'm trying to divine where this is going. The 134-page document is submitted. Freedom has serious concerns, because it was not what Freedom thought it had bargained for. Let's assume that at that point, Freedom says, no, I'm not going to deal anymore. Is it your contention that by virtue of having taken that position at that point in time, Freedom, in effect, has foregone any legal opportunity or ability that it would have had to contest the conformity of that agreement?
We do not contend that, Your Honor, because we believe that the court needs to look at Titan's ability to satisfy its contractual obligations, and the court still needs to consider the likelihood of closing. What we believe, Justice Jacobs, is that where you have a contract that imposes upon both parties a duty to work in good faith to get the deal done under shared obligations, you have a full calendar quarter to get that done. Even if the initial document is not what they expected, what they had obligated themselves to do is work in good faith to try to get the deal done. We had a situation here in which Freedom's own witnesses admitted repeatedly that Titan wanted to get this deal done and wanted to work with them. Stan Middleman, the chief executive officer, testified on pages A129 and A131 of the record that Freedom tried to satisfy every one of his concerns, in that even in late July, Titan was willing to do anything it could to work with him to move this deal forward. Brian Simon, the chief operating officer of Freedom, testified on pages A391 and A392 that he believes the parties would have gotten a deal done if they had engaged in these negotiations, and there was good reason for Titan to address all of Freedom's concerns. At the time this deal was signed, this was a market deal. As the court found, the market moved substantially afterwards, and as a result of those changes, Titan had a valuable contract. It would only get paid if it got a deal done, though. That's why Mr. Simon said he thought they would get it done. It makes total sense.
Now, the trial court said there's no question that Freedom had a right to walk away from the deal if the loan documents and credit agreement were not acceptable to Freedom. Was there a question on that?
The contract provides that the final documentation needed to be reasonably satisfactory. It's reasonably satisfactory. At page 25 of the opinion, the court said that because the initial draft was not what they were expecting, it was more complex, it concluded that the transaction had no momentum. But where you have a contract that provides 90 days to get it done, where you have shared obligations, where the breaching party admits that the non-breaching party is trying to meet its concerns, and where under this contract, when Freedom signed the deal, there must necessarily have been a form of agreement that it was willing to live with. It never shares that. It never engages at all in the negotiations. With all of those on one side, we believe it is legal error for the court to say the initial draft at the outset of the 90-day period isn't what they were expecting. So for that reason alone, we conclude the transaction would not have closed.
One last question. On your claim that the case should be remanded so that the court can consider the $75 million investment issue, what exactly would the court be considering? The likelihood that the full $75 million would be added to the kitty, so to speak?
Yeah, Justice Jacobs, we believe that instead of looking at the narrow question of whether or not Eric Brooks would have invested, what the court needed to do is look more broadly at the reasonable certainty that Titan would have been able to raise this money. The court already found Mr. Brooks would not have invested. The court at no point in its opinion considers would Titan have otherwise been able to raise the money.
We're talking about some kind of expert testimony as to what the state of the finance market was at that time.
We don't believe the expert testimony is necessary. We believe there's substantial evidence in the record, including Mr. Middleman's own concerns about the facility, the fact that there was another company, Fortress, which Ron Biscardi testified at page A279, was interested in putting money in. But we do think it needs to look more broadly than just at Mr. Brooks. If the court has no further
questions. Do you want to save your remaining 2 minutes?
Yes. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Judge Carpenter also said in his decision that to a substantial extent, Freedom held the keys to get out of this deal. And when Judge Carpenter was talking about Freedom holding those keys, it seems that he felt that Freedom, that he at least, His Honor felt, that Freedom lost the opportunity to use those keys because of the repudiation. And I'd like to concentrate my time on what we think Judge Carpenter should have considered and decided had he actually thought Freedom had the opportunity to use those keys. And I'd like
is
to...
Is your cross appeal? Is that your point on cross appeal?
It is a point on cross appeal, yes. It also addresses the direct... Well, I suppose it is the cross appeal, yes, Your Honor. The commitments that were due on July 24th, and they were due on July 24th, not the 25th, not the 26th, not in the future. There was no 45 days or 90 days to negotiate commitments. They had to be correct on the day they were delivered under the terms of the letter agreement. This court can look at those commitments and see what Judge Carpenter suggested when he talked about those keys very simply. And we can do it the same way that Stan Middleman did it when he got those two commitments faxed over to him at 5 p.m. on Friday of the 24th. And that is, you take the context commitment letter in one hand and you take the LBC commitment letter in the other hand and you compare the two of them. Now, why should this be important? Well, obviously, they're both committing to the same transaction, so that's one reason to compare them. But there's a better reason, a more important reason, which is before LBC wrote its commitment, Bill Peruzzi of Titan contacted LBC and said, we're going to need a commitment letter from you. Here's the form that Context is going to use. Please, we hope it'll serve your purposes. And Mr. Peruzzi testified that he wanted LBC to match, to track the language of the Context letter. In fact, he testified at A211, Mr. Peruzzi testified that he would have liked if the two commitment letters were identical. This is important because the two letters are not identical. In fact, they're very, very different. And the facial difference, the immediate differences that jump off the page were the
legally,
first...
Legally, what do we make of that fact or testimony? I mean, where is it going?
Well, because LBC felt compelled to change the letter when they were asked to use the same as Context, it raises the important question, what did LBC think it was committing to? And if LBC was committing to a different deal than the deal that was in our original term sheet, then that would not be a written binding commitment for the deal as noted in the term sheet, which is what Titan was obligated to deliver. So we can hypothesize any number of commitments LBC might have made that would have no connection to this term sheet that they were supposed to be committing for. So that's the reason. I'm sorry?
And so
when we look at the LBC commitment letter and we see, for example, that LBC is insisting on an indemnification for itself from Freedom that Titan's supposed to negotiate. And when we find out that LBC has said that it would not agree to indemnify Freedom, which is one of the express terms in the term sheet, that Freedom would have an indemnity from the lender, and LBC has testified that it would never agree to that, and that's at B50102, when LBC says that the deal that it's committing to is one documented principally according to the terms of this 100 plus page agreement, this repurchase agreement, that it has to be documented substantially in that form. LBC is not agreeing to a deal where that indemnity is inserted. They've testified that they never would agree to that indemnity. And
right.
So,
but what follows from that that's relevant to this appeal?
If the commitment letter from LBC is not the commitment letter required by the term sheet, then the condition precedent set forth in the term sheet has not been satisfied.
All right. Now, did the court so find, or are you contending that the court erred by not so finding?
I don't think the court did so find. I think some people might differ about it. Some people might think the court did find exactly that when the court said that we had the keys to get out of the deal, because Judge Carpenter, of course, said there was only one question he needed to decide, which predates the date of the delivery of the commitment letters. Judge Carpenter focused on Mr. Middleman's repudiation, which is not the point right now. The point is, if Judge Carpenter were to have clearly focused on this, he either would have been in accord with his other comments on the opinion, or he would have made a finding, and I'm asking this court to look at it. It's analogous to our summary judgment motion.
Well, all right, suppose we look at it.
Yes.
Are you asking us to remand so that the court to make a finding on that issue?
That is one option. I would prefer, since it is objectively clear that this commitment doesn't conform, I would obviously prefer if this court would simply rule that as a matter of law, these elements in this commitment letter cannot be squared with the term sheet. And we look at things like the fact that there's this indemnity provision.
Is it also the case that the court did not make a finding on the issue of whether agreement, the 134-page loan document?
I call it a repurchase agreement.
Repurchase agreement.
Or a proposed document, if you like.
conform to the requirements of the letter of intent?
The court did seem to make a finding on that. At least it was a little more clear to me that...
Did seem or did? Well, it matters, doesn't it?
It could matter. I think that this court could find that the court did. I think this court could find that it didn't. I suppose I contend that we contend that, yes, the court made a finding because the court said that...
Where did the court make a finding?
Well, that's... I think...
Where in the opinion did the court make a finding?
You mean the page number?
Yes.
The... Okay, so we're looking for the court's finding of that the agreement, it's when the court makes the statement that Mr. Middleman was expecting a substantially smaller document, which I know that Titan agrees now in their reply brief that Middleman may very well have been expecting a shorter document.
That was on page 27 of the exhibit to the Titan brief.
Thank you, Your Honor. So that's the finding that I'm thinking of when I think that the court made a finding. I'm not aware of any other finding that's more clear on that point.
But that's certainly suggestive of a finding, but it doesn't squarely, the court doesn't squarely come down and say, those concerns lead me to find that the repurchase agreement or the loan agreement or whatever you call it was non-conforming.
I completely agree with Your Honor, and that's why I struggled at first to say the answer to Your Honor's first question. It's hard to say whether that's a finding on this point, but it certainly is suggestive. What I would ask this court to do is look at the objective commitment letter and look at the fact that it, number one, it incorporates the fee letter by reference without including it.
We normally don't make factual findings in the first instance.
I'm aware.
And if, it appears that both sides are asking this court to remand to the trial court, although perhaps for different reasons. Is that fair?
I am aware of that, Your Honor, and I'm aware that a remand is certainly an option and certainly a perfectly appropriate option. I'm just tired of litigating this case, and I'm looking for any way we can get to the end of it as soon as possible. I'm just being honest.
Let me ask you about something that the trial court stated with regard to the commitment fee. There is no dispute that if the contract had not been breached, Titan would have received in payment for their efforts a fee equal to 1% of the facility.
That's a very – I'm sorry, did you want to finish?
That's what he said. And my question is, was there – no dispute about that?
Yeah, that's what I thought Your Honor's question was, which is why I jumped in. I apologize. But there is a dispute about that.
And you have a record site to where that dispute can be found?
Where the dispute can be found of whether there is or isn't a commitment fee? Yes, I think on that one I can come up with it. The term sheet at A668 is the page where the commitment fee is specified that the court is referring to. The draft repurchase agreement at A720 is the commitment fee that's actually in the repurchase agreement. The term commitment fee is there, and there's a whole explanation of what it is. And the two are completely different, utterly different. And then we have Mr. Medvikas, who was a lawyer for LBC, reviewing the agreement. And he reviewed this repurchase agreement, the big fat agreement that was sent to us, at B469. Mr. Medvikas said that he did not find the source of that commitment fee, the 17% on all the money, whether it's used or not. He did not find that in the term sheet, and he sent an email, which is what's at B469. He sent an email to Titan, saying, "Where is this? I can't find it." And he even said, "It's the commitment fee that's akin to an unused funds fee," which is very important because an unused funds fee in this business is when you have a revolving facility, which is, of course, a facility where you can borrow or not as time goes by.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, did Freedom argue that no damages for the commitment fee should have been awarded?
Well, I think I'm understanding Your Honor's question now. There was no discussion of damages for the commitment fee at at all during the trial. There was no evidence of the commitment fee, that, at least that I can recall, ever coming in. There was, frankly, there was a dearth of evidence of any damages at trial whatsoever. The closest we ever got was after the evidence closed, there was an attempt to use a demonstrative exhibit and try to have it admitted in evidence, which was denied.
So is it accurate to say then that the trial court's statement, there is no dispute that if the contract had not been breached, Titan would have received in payment for their efforts a fee equal to 1% of the facility?
That's an
accurate statement.
I think I misunderstood, Your Honor, the first time through this. But yes, if Titan had not breached the agreement by putting in the 17%, whether you use it or not, commitment fee into the repurchase agreement, and had actually written an agreement that matched the term sheet that had the 1%, and it had closed, they would have gotten the 1%. I agree with that. There's no dispute about that. The problem is, in the meantime, LBC's commitment said, we are committing to this repurchase agreement, not simply to the term sheet. It has to be documented pursuant to the repurchase agreement, and it has to contain the changes we request. And one of those things that was different about that repurchase agreement that LBC stuck to was this new, completely different commitment fee, which had the effect of making it no longer a revolving facility. That's why I got confused about what Your Honor was asking me. I guess the judge is correct that if there had been no breach by either party, there would have been that 1% commitment. But the problem is, because Titan changed it unilaterally, that had the cascading effect of making the LBC commitment for that change deal not conform with what they were supposed to be committing to for our deal. It's another one of the...
Maybe we're still not connecting. The trial judge awarded damages equal to the commitment fee, correct?
Yes, he did. His Honor
did.
Was
that proper or not?
Well, it wasn't proper because since Titan did not comply with the condition precedent and did not show that the deal would have closed, there should not have been any damages awarded for things they would have gotten had the deal closed. Remember, this commitment fee, it says expressly, is 1% at closing. So, for starters, there had to have been a closing, or we have to be able to find that there would have been a closing if the negotiations had continued.
And that argument was made below.
Emphatically, that there would have been no closing, that there was no chance of this deal closing, and that's something that the judge did find, that he said that it probably would not have closed. So there we have a fairly clear finding that the evidence showed that Titan had not met its burden, which was Titan's burden, of course, to prove that the deal would have closed, that there's a reasonable certainty that the deal would have closed, not the opposite, which is what Judge Carpenter found. So maybe, hopefully I've connected. I apologize for taking so long. But it is an important question. I'm glad I was able to get there in the end. The other point that I would like to touch upon, by the way, counsel in his argument said something about whether Freedom's perception of the commitment letters entitled them not to perform. And I don't want there to be any confusion about that. We're not arguing and not claiming that our subjective intent or subjective perception is an excuse for non-performance. We agree with Titan that it's an objective test. Either these commitments were good or they weren't. And if the commitments were good, which we don't think they were, then either the deal, Titan proved that the deal would have closed or they didn't. But it's not, we're not saying, oh, just because we felt we didn't think it was a good deal, we could walk away. We're not suggesting that.
That's what's so puzzling to me, at least. We have, excuse me, a finding by the trial court that this is a deal that had no momentum and it probably would not have closed.
Right.
And that, of course, is a finding that favors your side. On the other hand, we have both sides, conceding that there was no specific finding by the trial court of that either the LBC commitment letter or the what you call the repurchase agreement conformed to the requirements of the letter of intent. So how do we reconcile what appears to be findings or lack of findings going in both directions, in opposite directions?
I think they can be reconciled actually fairly easily. If I understand Your Honor's question, which is, I may not be completely on
my
mark.
The reason for the question is that if I understand Mr. Ross's argument correctly, he's saying that the finding that the contract would probably not have closed, the deal would not have closed, is legally insufficient. It's a nullity, absent specific findings of nonconformity of either the LDC commitment letter or the repurchase agreement or both.
I suppose it could always be clearer, there could always be more findings, but if the court made an express finding, which it did, and there is substantial evidence in the record to back it up that this deal would not have closed, I think that's sufficient.
So are you is it your contention that there no finding was necessary, no specific findings, or that the findings were made but they're implicit?
The findings were made here. Here I'm confident to say that we believe the findings were made and they are supported by substantial evidence. This deal probably would not have closed. Titan didn't meet its burden.
Are you saying that those findings, although not explicit, are subsumed by the finding that the deal probably wouldn't have closed?
I don't know what Your Honor means by subsumed. The critical finding that I'm focusing on is...
There are no specific explicit findings of nonconformity, correct?
All correct. The only thing the judge does is refer to our concerns. I'm sorry.
There is a finding that the deal probably wouldn't have closed. Does the finding number two, by implication, compel us to find or permit us to find that there were implicit findings on point number one?
Absolutely, because the part that you read to Mr. Ross during his argument goes to that, because the judge said, he pointed out that Titan itself had concerns about the commitments, Freedom had concerns, and then it's in that context that he talks about how it probably would not have closed. So, although
well,
I suppose...
If you're right, then there's no need to remand the case, is there?
That sounds good to me, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, you would start it out by making an argument from which it followed that there would be a remand. So where are you?
I'm trying to leave no defense undefended. There is an easy way out of this case, which I agree with Your Honor. If Your Honor agrees that the court properly found, based on substantial evidence, that the deal probably would not have closed, then we win, end of story. We have to deal with the 1% commitment fee, which was only on closing. But other than that, the decision could be affirmed on
this. I wasn't expressing a view. I was just asking a question.
I understand. Yes, Your Honor. Well, if that view were adopted by the court, I beg your pardon.
Let's move beyond his reference to the obvious. Tell me, what are the specific facts that allow the inference that were found by the trial judge that allow the inference that the deal probably would not have closed?
Okay. One is, some of these are also facts that show that the condition precedent was not met, which is, of course, a separate issue, but they're intertwined. Because since we have a commitment from LBC, which was for a deal that was other than the deal specified in the term sheet, there's no easy way to get from that deal, from that repurchase agreement, to the much simpler document that Mr. Middleman was expecting, to the document that had, for example, an indemnity by the lender of Freedom, a document that was negotiated by two parties instead of three, because, of course, this added LBC as a whole new party with a right to consent. It changed the entire basis of the negotiation, and in a case involving an agreement to negotiate, that's important. We have the fact that LBC was insisting on its own indemnity from Freedom. We have the fact that the 1% commitment fee was changed into this 17% on the whole loan, whether you use it or not, which is a fundamental... I beg your pardon, Your Honor, my time has run out. May I complete my thought?
Yes.
The change from a 1% commitment fee to a 17% commitment fee is a fundamental change in the revolving nature of the document, and contrary to what both LBC's lawyers and Titan's lawyers at DLA Piper thought of the term sheet. So clearly contradictory. Fact that LBC would be entitled to have consent for any action, inaction, waiver, and so forth, all of these things are new and different terms. Even the fact that there was a whole side agreement between LBC and Titan, which was never given to Freedom on the due date for the commitment, but which is incorporated into the commitment, shows a whole shadow negotiation, a whole separate world that's different from two people negotiating over a simpler, more flexible document, which is what everyone agreed was going to happen here. And even Titan, in his final reply brief, said that Mr. Middleman may very well have been expecting a smaller, more flexible document. So even the fact that we got a, I'm sorry, I'm giving a long answer, and I know I'm out of time. I don't want to go too far. Just stop me.
I understand your drift. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to address a few issues from counsel's argument. First of all, and I don't want to rehash my old argument, but I apologize if I was unclear. We do believe, in response to a question that Justice Jacobs asked counsel, that the court has found that that Titan had the commitments and the LBC committed. That's the language of pages 4 and 14 of the opinion that I quoted earlier. Also, counsel started out by talking about what Mr. Middleman did when he got this LBC commitment letter, how he held it up. That's absolutely not true. The court made a contrary finding. The court found that Mr. Middleman walked away from this deal for one reason and one reason only. He didn't like the economics. The court explicitly found on page 22 of its opinion that there were no concerns about the commitment letter playing any role in any decision that he made. Mr. Middleman didn't look at the commitment letters. He testified he didn't know what to do with them, so he sent them off to his lawyer. So the suggestion that he had these concerns, it's just not supported by the record. Counsel argued that there were fundamental variations between the commitment letter and the form of agreement and what was provided for in the contract. And I'd like to just address those briefly. First, counsel said that LBC did not commit to do the deal in the contract. And that contract is the April 2009 contract between Titan and Freedom. If you look at Exhibit 382 at page Titan 004011, that's the LBC commitment letter. The very first sentence of the second paragraph said that the facility is to be structured upon the terms and conditions as described in Titan's April 7th, 2009 engagement letter with Freedom and the summary of terms and conditions attached to that letter. That document is Exhibit 35. It's the contract. That's what LBC was committing to go on. Council also argues that we dramatically changed the facility by providing for a 17% interest rate. The contract says 17% is due on the facility and has a, can I just finish this one sentence here?
Sure.
And it has a prepayment penalty, which says that if they prepay the facility, they have to ensure we get a 17% rate of return. That's because, as Mr. Middleman testified, 17% on the entire facility is consistent with the discussions he had with Titan. Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess. Please rise.